if this isn't a plague, what do plagues look like? Like, I'm having a hard time imagining. Either they have completely ceased, or this has got to be one. I can't imagine what else would be a plague. So on one hand, I want to say, this feels like a plague, and I don't know that I want to slide into such a modern point of view to say, no, everything is scientific, everything is germ-based, and I believe all of that is true. I just think you got to have biblical categories to talk about these things.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Pastor Theologian Show. Today, we are talking with CPT fellow Jim Samra, who is the senior pastor at Calvary Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We talk with Jim in this episode about the movement of God during the coronavirus, to what extent and how is God active in this global crisis, as well as issues related to pastoral presence during this season. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's get right to it.
Zach, I am thrilled, as I know you are, to have on the podcast today my good friend, our good friend, Jim Samra, who is a CPT fellow, of course, and the senior pastor of Calvary Church in Grand Rapids. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Todd. I'm glad to join you, too.
We're delighted to have you, brother. We were talking before we turned the record button on about Oxford. You are a graduate of Oxford, the DPhil program over there. And Zach, my partner in crime at the CPT, has just accepted an offer to go to Oxford to do the DPhil. And so there's a connection there. But Jim, you and I first met at Christ Church College Dining Hall.
I do remember it.
Do you remember that in Oxford? We had mutual friends, Joel Lawrence and Joel Willits, who are both CPT fellows, but we connected. We had a day conference between Cambridge and Oxford. And
it was like going to Hogwarts with you.
Exactly. Well, we are delighted to be able to talk with you, Jim, today. And we have been connecting with some of our CPT fellows and pastors to talk with them about the frontline work that you all are engaged with in shepherding your congregations and maintaining your own sanity and spiritual vibrancy in the midst of what is an unprecedented reality in our lifetimes, of course, with COVID-19 and the global pandemic and the shutdown of the United States and social distancing and all the implications and impacts of that. I don't know. Lord willing, hopefully we won't ever see this again in our lifetime, but we certainly haven't seen anything like this in our lifetime. And so we want to talk with you about that and what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what you're learning, and know that this conversation is helpful to other pastors and folks that will be listening to this podcast. But before we dive into that conversation, just to ask you, brother, how you are doing with everything. How are you doing personally? How are you doing spiritually? How's your family doing?
So yes, it's a mixed bag. And so I think on one hand, you know, we did this, Todd, we had that really great Zoom call with other pastors. And I heard some other of our colleagues say, you know what, everybody is on break to some extent, but why am I so tired?
Yes.
I do feel that. I feel like, wow, this is exhausting. And so personally, I think part of it for me, as I've kind of reflected back, is that decisions that I think just kind of got made naturally, now every one of them has to be prayed through in new ways, thought through, debated. You're making changes on the fly, trying to think through, okay, like for Holy Week, like, well, what are we going to do about Good Friday? Like in the past, it's like, well, we kind of do what we did last year. Let's just tweak it this way or that way. What are we going to do about Monday, Thursday? Every decision feels like, are we going to meet? Are we going to do it over Zoom? Are we going to do something else? Yes. So I find that to be exhausting. And so we're trying to do some daily videos and just trying to think through, man, Lord, you know, every day trying to think through, well, what should we share today? So I find it to be a bit tiring, actually, personally. I think for our family, Todd, you and I have talked about this a little bit, is that, you know, there's an unexpected blessing in kind of this forced Sabbath rest and re-engaging with new rhythms and new family things that we can do. And so I do have a great empathy for, we have a lot of singles in our congregation or a lot of elderly shut-ins who are by themselves. And I just think, man, Lord, that's an extra heavy burden. To be here with my family, my wife and four kids, and to be able to watch movies together and do games, we still go a little stir crazy. Yeah. But I would think, boy, being by yourself, and you know, we got some pretty heartrending stories in our congregation of people in dementia units that their spouse can no longer come visit them. They're in a nursing home and they're by themselves. Yes. And so I think that on one hand, we're praying earnestly for them and trying to minister to them. But our family feels like, well, there's some blessing in this. There's some silver lining on this cloud. I think for our church, it's been a pretty unprecedented time of kind of wilderness. And, you know, the blessing of wilderness is that things are stripped away. And the terrible thing about wilderness is that things are stripped away. And so you're kind of there with God in a new and fresh way. And wilderness, you know, according to Deuteronomy, it's a place to humble you. It's a place to come face to face with your own self-sufficiencies and pride and have those stripped away. So I think as a church, I'm watching God do some really incredible things, but also just some pretty ramped up spiritual warfare and lots of anxiety and fear. And I feel it. Our family feels it. We feel it at church. And so, yeah, I think that's in a completely unclear way. That's how it's going.
Yes. And what are you doing, Jim? May I ask kind of on a personal level, just to stay grounded and encouraged yourself? I know you have a routine of spiritual disciplines. Are you leaning into those in a fresh way or taking up new spiritual practices or habits during these days? Or how's that looking for you?
So yeah, prayer has been incredibly important, and that's always sort of been important in my life, but just the opportunity now to say, so here's a battle I face, Todd, is that, okay, maybe it's the fleshly part of me or the American part of me or the human part of me or the whatever. I look at this and think, man, all the things we could do right now to get ready for when this is over and to kind of want to run even faster and like, oh, if we prepared this and did that. And I feel like the Lord's saying, look, how many times am I going to give you a sort of government authorized Sabbath? And so I'm trying to balance between how much do I plan for the future, pray about the future, even think about the future? And how much do I just try to sit in this and rest in it, enjoy the family time, do the ministry I've been given to do? And so Sabbath in a new way, just trying to think, I still have a Sabbath day, but trying to think of this whole thing as a Sabbath. I don't know if it's like a year of Jubilee or something like that, which is a kind of a 50-year kind of thing. But prayer, still trying to fast some. But yeah, some new rhythms and new patterns. And to be honest, the prayer and the time with the Lord and just kind of, I found myself a lot more in Old Testament prophets and sort of hearing the Lord. And one of the prophets that's been super meaningful to me has been Habakkuk. And as you know, Habakkuk is crying out to the Lord, Lord, are you not paying any attention to the wickedness? Are you not watching what's going on in the world? And then the Lord says, hey, I'm sending something. And in Habakkuk, it's the Babylonians. But I've been kind of reading it as COVID-19 as a sort of the Babylonians. And kind of especially get to Habakkuk 3 and the idea that when God shows up and moves, you know, plagues go before him. And the whole idea about, hey, look, there's no oil in the barn and there's no fruit on the vine, but I'm going to rejoice in God, my Savior. And he makes my feet like the feet of a deer to stand on the mountains. That's just been some of those things, just kind of watching from a big picture, 30,000 foot view, what the Lord's been doing. That's been kind of balm for my soul. I think when I turn on the news, CNN, USA Today, whatever, I get frightened and I feel like I have decently strong faith. I feel like, but then when I go back into God's word and I see God's in control, this is what he's up to. I find that to be really reassuring to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I ask you about that, Jim, just to dig in a little bit here on this idea of reading our current situation through the lens of Scripture? I mean, that's a very biblical Christian intuition and is right in so many ways. I have wrestled with in the past, and then I've thought about quite a bit now, you know, the Bible has a lot to say about plagues and God sending plagues on people, right? And have you what do you make of that theologically in the providence of God in the United States and all of that? I know that, you know, as Christians, we can push that in a way that can become really problematic and unhelpful, I think. Right. On the other hand, we can become sort of functional atheists in the way we think about God's providence in the difficult things that strike us corporately or nationally. I don't know where the right balance is there. I'm anxious about it as a theological formulation, and particularly talking about it out loud, right? You know, I mean, I remember in September 11 and some of the things that were said by Christian, you know, prominent Christian voices at the time, and it was whatever you make of it theologically, it certainly was painful for the country to hear Christians say those kinds of things. That doesn't mean it was wrong. Right. It just means it was at the very least painful and maybe not pastorally prudent. What do you make of all that, Jim?
So, Todd, I feel that intensely. Like, I feel nervous to answer the question.
Yes, right, and right. That's exactly what I feel.
So I'm with you on that. I think what I would say between you, me, Zach, and the listeners is I do want to at least be honest to say, number one, if this isn't a plague, what do plagues look like? Like, I'm having a hard time imagining either they have completely ceased or this has got to be one. I can't imagine what else would be a plague. So one way to say is, you know what, there were plagues in the Old Testament. It is interesting, I think, if I remember right, if you read Matthew 24, I don't think plagues are listed when Jesus is kind of talking about the end. I think there's earthquakes.
Okay.
But at some point, you would think just by analogy, you would also expect, you know, wars, rumors of wars. He doesn't say plagues, but I would think, well, probably he would expect those too.
Biblically, that's kind of the eschatological imagery.
Yeah, that's right.
Prophetic, you know, imagery.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse or however you want to read Revelation doing that. So on one hand, I want to say this feels like a plague, and I don't know that I want to slide into such a modern point of view to say, no, everything is scientific, everything is germ-based, and I believe all of that is true. I just think you got to have biblical categories to talk about these things. The thing I don't want to do is I don't want to say, so even yesterday I did we're doing the kind of these daily videos for our church, and the passage that I felt compelled to talk through was 1 Chronicles 21, which is the plague for David's sin. And one of the points that—
For
the census, that's right, thank you. One of the points at least worth making is that people, innocent people, seem to be suffering. And so what I don't want to do is say this is a plague on all humans equally, that everybody has done evil things and that God is particularly punishing each and every person. I like to think of it, again, back to the Habakkuk passage. You know, in the Habakkuk 3, the Lord sort of rises up and he comes. And there seems to me some specific moments in human history when the Lord seems to be more active than at others. And at times he's sort of like, you're like, arise, Lord, come do something. And at other times you're kind of, your breath is taken away because he's striding across the earth. And every time the Lord comes, it's, I think, both somewhat in judgment or warning and somewhat in salvation and blessing. And it's all a foretaste of when Jesus returns. And so what I would want to say is, as opposed to the Lord is sitting on his throne punishing everyone with a plague, I just want to say that he's moving. And Habakkuk seems to say when God moves, there are plagues and pestilence, they follow him, but also mercy and salvation and grace. And to be honest, it's been crazy to me the amount of evangelism and evangelistic opportunities. I feel like God's getting people's attention. And
for
so I look and I go, well, I don't want to say this plague is a blessing from the Lord. I don't want to say it's a curse from the Lord. I just want to say it feels like it's a movement of the Lord. And that seems to fit with how the Bible presents it.
And I think the main kind of theological implication that people are going to be really uncomfortable with, and one that you already alluded to, is the anytime someone says this, it's funny that we call them acts of God, but an act of God, like the... just something that's a natural phenomenon like a pandemic. Anytime people start to assign some measure of divine agency to it, then people, and reasonably so, they logically connect that to individual people who are suffering because of this, and God is punishing this yeah. person in this act of God or this natural disaster or this the spread of this disease. But to your point, and I think that the Chronicles passage is, I don't know if it's helpful is the right word, but it illustrates for us, God moved in response, came in judgment. And I believe there's also reference to God's mercy, I believe, in that passage.
Yeah, that's why it stops.
That's why David chooses right. the plague, if that's right. But God moves in judgment against David. And if I'm remembering right, if you were just in this yesterday, Jim, you'll be able to help me remember. But like tens of thousands of people died.
70,000.
Yes. So I don't know if that makes us feel better, but it does illustrate us to us the fact that these people died is not an incitement of judgment against those people in particular.
No, David makes that exact point. He's like, I sinned. I'm the shepherd. Yes. Why are you punishing them?
And that, yeah. And I don't know. That doesn't make me feel a lot better about the pandemic, honestly.
It doesn't make me feel better about it either. But the theological connection is, okay, this is Mount Moriah where this is happening. Mm. So you got Abraham sacrificing Isaac, and Isaac didn't do anything wrong. You've got people being punished for David's sin, and they didn't do anything wrong on Arunah's threshing floor. But it's the site of the temple, and it's the place where Jesus is going to come. And he's going to suffer for all our sins and be punished. And so you have these stories of the innocent being punished for the sins of the wicked. And somehow, if we don't allow that plagues and these kinds of things happen, how do we make sense of what Jesus did
yes.
or what he's going to do when he returns?
Yes.
And the judgment that is falling as a result of this pandemic, I mean, you want to, I even feel comfortable saying that to the point. Like, it feels uncomfortable.
I know.
From kind of like a modern American, even evangelical, theological perspective to refer to a pandemic as a judgment of God or a movement of God in some sense. But one of the most striking, pains or however you want to that will result of this is certainly and is resulting is economic. I mean, yes. the United States is however many people end up dying as a result of this. The United States and the global economy is it's fair to say being brought to its knees by this.
Yes.
Just being completely crushed under the weight, and a decade or more of economic growth is going to be wiped out and has been wiped out. And if that's not a movement of God, I don't know what you can call a movement of God at that point.
Zach, that's why I agree wholeheartedly. Mm. Like, I think we ought to be careful not to sort of turn it into more than it is, which I think either you or Todd was saying. It's not individual punishment for individuals. But if God can't move in human history in these kinds of ways, I think we've left ourselves in a real bind.
And if we're not willing to hear God speaking through global national events like this, if we're not willing to stop and as God's people be willing to listen, what is God saying to us? What is God saying to the nation? What is God saying to the world in these
events? Yeah. And it almost strains credulity, it seems to me, if you've got a mind and imagination shaped by the Bible and believe that God works in human history, to not look at the situation we find ourselves in today and say, to your point, Jim, at the very least, God is on the move. At the very least, we say that. Right. We make a fairly neutral description of the fact that God is doing something significant without necessarily making a moral discrimination about it or judgment one way or another about the value of what God is doing. And we sort of hold back. Just an anecdote to this point, my daughter, Marta Kate, came into my study last week, and she was super, I guess, excited. She had her Bible open to 2 Chronicles chapter 7, and it's going to make us sound like a more spiritual family than we are that my sixth grade daughter just randomly has 2 Chronicles open in the middle of the afternoon. but there it was, and I don't know what she was doing. You know, seriously. But, you know, we go to 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14, about if people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face, so on and so forth. She had her eyes fixed on verse 13 about the Lord saying he's going to shut up the heavens so that there's no rain and command the locusts to devour the land and send pestilence among my people. But what was so charming was she circled the word pestilence in her Bible and evidently got on the iPad or something and looked up the word pestilence. And she wrote down in the margin, I think it was extended pandemic or something like this, but had the word pandemic in the definition. And she pointed literally. So she points to the word pestilence in the Bible, points down to the word pandemic, and then looks at me and I'm like, yeah, I know. Isn't that incredible, Marta Kate? And she says, she looks at me with a smile on her face and says, boy, this Bible sure knows what it's talking about. That's what she said. And there was something powerful about that for me. The way in which, with childlike faith, she reads the description of Scripture onto our present circumstances. So, anyways, I appreciate you, Jim, your wisdom on this and talking
Can
about
God.
Can I
add
God
a story
moving.
That's sort of similar?
Yeah, by all means.
So last Palm Sunday, or this past Palm Sunday, you know, just we were using Matthew's version of the Palm Sunday text in Matthew 21. And, you know, we're live streaming our services. And so you're like, okay, Lord, this is not ideal, but how do you do Palm Sunday at home? Does everybody go cut like a branch off their tree in the front yard and like lay it down?
Yes.
Well, I kind of felt as I studied the passage, you know, there's not just branches, there's clothes. So we kind of had everybody go get, you know, a favorite article of clothing and then just kind of an act of worship, lay it down before the screen, kind of in acknowledging Jesus as king. And so we're sort of talking through that. And so, you know, trying to picture what Palm Sunday looked like on that first Sunday. And then thinking through what Palm Sunday looks like today. And all of a sudden I found on like CNN or wherever, you know, here are pictures of Jerusalem just empty. You know, nobody on the streets, everybody under quarantine. And while I'm praying and reading through this and thinking, I feel like the Lord kind of guides my eyes over to Matthew 23. And the very last verses are, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you know, I've longed to take you under my wings. And he says, but your house is going to be left to you desolate.
Wow.
And of course, I go to BDAG and look up desolate and the Greek word there. They list as their definition, isolated, in a state of isolation, in a state of abandonment. And I'm reading it and I think, okay, well, this is not the end. Like Matthew 24 is going to tell us about end times. But it does seem like a sign, and you're like, this is crazy. Jerusalem is desolate. I mean, it's empty and abandoned. And it just had this very sort of like, maybe like your daughter felt like, wait a second, this Bible isn't just some sort of history book. Like, this is what it's talking about.
And Jim, my sixth grade daughter doesn't have a DPhil from Oxford or a PhD from Cambridge, but there was something patently obvious about the connection for her without much theological reflection. That was humbling to me and challenging to me. Let me ask you about another thing you mentioned, which I so appreciated. As you know, I've done a bit of work on the theme of wilderness in the Old Testament and how, in particular, Paul scripts his congregations into the role of wilderness wanderers. So I love this idea of drawing on the biblical metaphor of wilderness to script ourselves and our people into the role of wilderness wanderers. Quite a few folks that I've talked to, we've talked to, I will even say, have been using the language of exile, that we feel like we're in exile right now. But you are the first one I've talked to who has gone to the wilderness. And I just wonder if you'd reflect with us for a moment on the choice of wilderness and the advantages of kind of framing things up in that light as opposed to exile. And I don't mean to assume you're putting them against each other, preferring the one over the other intentionally, but just reflect a little bit on the use of wilderness as the metaphor here.
In my kind of reading or theology, wilderness is the big category, and exile is the more specific category, meaning you can be in the wilderness for lots of reasons besides exile. So Jesus is there for other reasons. the children of Israel are there in the wilderness initially for other reasons. And then when they don't go into the promised land, they're back in the wilderness for exile. I just found pastorally trying to always make the call as to whether something is an exile or not to sometimes be confusing. I do think that this has a feel of what an exile would feel because of plague, exile, sin, those sorts of things. But to me, the wilderness category tends to be the less pejorative one in the sense of you're not making a dogmatic call as to why somebody's where they are. So Job is in the wilderness, but he's not in exile. And so I tend to, the prophetic side of me likes the term exile, and the pastor side of me says, no, use wilderness and let God tell people if they're in exile or not.
Yes. Yes. I like that a ton.
That's helpful.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Jim, how is this going to change, do you think, the way you pastor and the way your church goes about being church? What are going to be the lasting effects and impacts of COVID-19 on Calvary Church in Grand Rapids and your ministry there?
It's a great question. One of the things, Todd, I really appreciate about the way you and Gerald and others have led us in the Center for Pastor Theologians is even just if you think about the name, you guys, you've named us, we all named it, but you named us. We're Pastor Theologians.
Yes.
And what I love about that is it feels like you've tried to give equal balance to two words.
Yeah.
Like we're not pastoral theologians, we're pastor theologians.
Yes. Yes.
And so we're not theological pastors. I just love the way you guys have done that. And I think the way you've led us as a group of pastors and theologians is to really recognize, you know, we're both at the same time. And then any good theology that we do comes out of being a pastor first. I think one of the lasting impacts for me personally and for our church, if I could just start there, and for the CPT, is I feel like perhaps during seasons where God is not at moving as tangibly, those are times for theology. Those are times when we are reflecting and being more theological. At times like this, you used the word, I think, at the beginning of our conversation, the word shepherd. I feel like these are very pastoral times, meaning I can't use theology really to make my decisions. Like my theology tells me we should meet together. My theology also tells me the governor doesn't want us to, at least in Michigan. My theology tells me, you know what, we shouldn't be doing the Lord's Supper with everybody kind of in their own homes, but we did it this past Easter. We normally do baptisms, but we couldn't do baptisms, so we tried to do communion. I think we're supposed to be together to do it. And other people have different theology. It's fine. I think in these cases, theology can't really give you the answer. And what's giving you the answer is, well, what is my chief shepherd doing? And I'm going to just try to listen and follow and go where he's going. And how do I pastor my people in the same sort of way? So I feel like right now the emphasis through COVID-19 is pushing us towards the pastor side of this pastor theologian designation.
Yes.
And I think how that's changing us as a church is, you know, we as a church are wrestling through, should we have applied for money from the government to help keep our staff employed? I don't know that theology will ultimately answer that question as much as there's so many Romans 14 disputable matters where you're like, look, one church may decide to do one thing and another church may decide to do another. Each got to be fully convinced in their own mind, and it's got to be by faith. So I feel one of the lasting changes is, you know, just this new emphasis again on pastoring, being pastoral, listening to the Lord's voice, being a shepherd, being led by our shepherd, and then leading our people as a shepherd, caring for those who are hurting, those sorts of things. I feel like even at our church, there were a number of things that I think we had, I wouldn't say drifted off of, but for example, we were kind of having more of a focus on maybe less on small groups and community and more focus on sort of teaching and equipping classes and those sorts of things. Well, the Lord immediately put a halt to all the teaching classes and spent a lot more time pushing, now it's virtual, but community and how do you be good neighbors to one another? And so recognizing it's a very pastoral moment and how do we as a church, you know, our food bank is still open. And so we've got people who are necessary workers that are working manning the food bank and trying to think through, okay, what is a church is absolutely essential. It's the pastoral things that we're doing right now, the caring things, the preaching things, the leading things, the worship things, and the things that are less essential, the programs and some of the other things that we're doing. So I feel like that's a real like wake up call for us from a Sabbath rest point of view, programming point of view, how much stuff we're doing, and a push towards the pastor side of the pastor theologian designation.
No, that's a good word. It reminds me, the way you framed that up, it reminds me of when I was at Bethlehem Baptist years ago now as a college pastor. And I remember John Piper at the time saying, someone was asking him about how do you prepare people, your congregation, to suffer? And he says, you need to preach and teach a theology of suffering when people aren't suffering. Because when they are thrust into suffering, it will be too late to theologize at that point. And you will just need with tears in your eyes to be present to and with people in a shepherding capacity. And that is always that struck with me over the years in pastoral ministry of, to your point, Jim, in a sense, the theologian part of the pastor-theologian equation is building the frameworks, the theology, the theological imagination, the sensibilities, the biblical awareness, and so on, so that when something like COVID-19 happens, we can, and the congregation can kick more into the pastoral and interpersonal dynamics, being bolstered and steadied by the theology that's been built over the course of your ministry. So thank you. I really like that.
That I think is really helpful. I'm going to take a stab at an on-the-fly analogy here, but just because I think this is important. So we'll see how this goes. But to your point, Jim, and your point, Todd, about in the trial or the season of suffering, it's kind of too late to prepare your people for suffering.
Yeah.
So instruction isn't going to be all that helpful. I mean, certainly you can take a stab at it, but it's almost like, you know, if you're coaching a little league team or something like that, you can't teach a kid how to throw a baseball when he's out on the mound during the game. You need to instruct him or her beforehand. And then during the actual performance, such as it is, you know, you could make this in a performance analogy. Your role is that of encouragement and support, not instruction. The coach will encourage, the director will encourage the performer or the athlete, but you're past the time of preparing or instructing them on how to perform in that moment. So I think there's a helpful analogy there, maybe, I hope, for just how we pastor in that... something like this, a season of suffering for God's people, or a season of difficulty, however you want to frame it up, it's game time. As far as the analogy goes, you can't coach them at this point. You can encourage them. You can be present with them. You can pastor them and shepherd them. But it's kind of too late, maybe, to teach them.
Well, I want to push back on that a little.
Please.
Because I want to endorse it pretty completely, but I want to maybe follow your metaphor through a little more to say.
Okay, let's go.
I agree with you that it's probably not the time to teach fundamentals, but there is a level of coaching during game time where you're reminding them of stuff, like the batter's up to bat, and you're like, okay, it's a full count. Remember, fight this pitch off or whatever it may be. And I do think there's a level at which as pastors and teachers, we always at least I always want to be saying something new or something, you know, and I remember, you know, Peter says in 2 Peter, hey, I'm just reminding you of stuff you already know.
Totally.
That there is a level of, when you say encouragement, I hear also teaching that reminds them of the basics, you know, God's word and God's prayer and community and loving one another. It's not really, hey, look, let's sit down and talk through, like you're saying, a theology of suffering. It's kind of hard. People aren't listening for that right now. But they are up to bat, and you can shout a few words of encouragement. And some of those words of encouragement are, remember what we practice. Remember this.
Yes.
If you do nothing else, at least swing at this pitch. You know, it's the full count pitch swing.
Yes. Yeah.
So your question of how is this going to change us?
Yes.
maybe another sort of shout out and appreciation, I think, maybe to you, Todd, is that a couple of years ago, you gave us a book in the CPT on you preaching through Titus that came out of you preaching through Titus.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't remember how many years ago that was, but I kind of tucked away in the back of my mind and I thought, well, preaching through Titus. And you were pretty passionate, like, this is a great little book. And, you know, and kind of a way that I found really encouraging. It wasn't pushy, but it was like, hey, if you guys haven't ever thought of preaching through Titus, think about it. Mm. So I just kind of, for whatever reason, you know how the Spirit does, he kind of causes you to remember a comment beyond what you think you probably should have. So this last summer, as I'm praying through what are we supposed to do next, the book of Titus came up. And that comment popped back into my mind. And I thought, well, Todd said this is a really great book to go through with the congregation. And so I prayed about it and I felt like we're doing a topical series, but Titus is choosing our topics. And so like when it says in Titus 2:1, teach sound doctrine, we did a series on sound doctrine. It wasn't from Titus, but it was because of Titus. So when this pandemic hit, I was like, oh, you know, maybe I need to preach some different stuff. And then I looked and I thought, well, I'm on the point in Titus where we should be preaching on self-control. That was the message that was supposed to be up.
Wow.
So I'm studying it. And Todd, as you know, and Vec too, that, you know, self-control is a big word in the book of Titus. And you think, well, this is one of the huge things we need right now. The idea that so much is being stripped away, people have to develop self-control so they can make decisions when society or structures are no longer there to make decisions in the same kind of way. The next week, I think, was on endurance. You know, we were in Titus 2 where it says, you know, be sound in faith and love and in endurance. And you think, well, this is perfect. People need endurance. In Michigan, at least, the governor had just come out with another, like, extend the stay-at-home order. And it kind of felt like, okay, we thought we had a sprint, but it looks like it's a marathon.
Yeah.
And you're just, I think that what the Lord is doing is a lot of that Titus kind of stuff, which is self-control, holy, disciplined, godly lives, and is kind of retraining us. And so I'm hoping that one of the benefits that come out of this, to your point about spiritual disciplines, are these practices, these self-control. Okay, look, we got to figure out how to do school now. We can't just have teachers telling us when to start and bells ringing, telling us when to quit. So I'm hoping that's one of the benefits as well, is a level of endurance, enduring suffering, self-control, godliness, holiness, discipline that the Lord is doing above and beyond anything we could plan on our own.
That's a great word. And I'll just throw in from Titus, the discipline, if you can call it this, of blessed hope, of waiting, hoping for the Lord's return. And in a sense, I think of the anticipation that's building in our house for relief from the social distancing qualification. And that's a little shadow of Christian eschatology, it seems to me. This morning, we were reading for devotions as a family, Psalm 98, and we talked about why are the trees and the rivers clapping their hands when the Lord comes to judge the world? That was a fascinating conversation, but hoping. Jim, last question is you know, I think there is some anxiety. In fact, I was just on the phone with someone a couple of days ago asking about resources in the Christian. It was actually a Jewish person who I went to Israel with, not a Christian, but he was asking about Christian resources for thinking about the importance of presence in light of the social distancing and Christians, quote unquote, worshiping without being physically present with one another. He was talking about in his Orthodox Jewish tradition how that's a bit of a challenge kind of conceptually and theologically and whether Christians have similar sorts of challenges. And I've heard other Christians talk about their anxiety of, wow, we're going to do all this Zoom calls and virtual worship services. Will people want to come back to worshiping together in a set space and place with one another? What are your thoughts on that? Is that a point of anxiety for you? Do you think people will be delighted to return to connecting with one another physically in terms of personal presence? Or are you anxious about the impact of this for further individualism that I think we already wrestle with as evangelicals and as Christians and as Americans?
Wow, for a final question, that's huge.
I'm sorry. That was a big one.
There's so much to say, so I'll try. I'm a talker, so I'll try to limit it. One, I would say that I wrote my dissertation on why church is important and gathering together, and I'm completely, I'm not for distance and separating and all that kind of stuff. So this was hard for me theologically, and I felt like the Lord had to say, this is why your theology is not going to get you through this. You're going to have to allow that there are some exceptions and some other kinds of things that don't fit into your nice my nice sort of theological boxes. One of the passages that was helpful for me was when Hezekiah wants to celebrate the Passover and not everybody's clean and worthy. And the Hezekiah says, hey, look, I know you've got requirements, but we just weren't able to get those done. Could you please have mercy and let them celebrate Passover?
Yes.
And I thought,
a little
to myself,
accommodation.
Like this past Sunday we did communion and some people used orange juice and they didn't have any grape juice or wine in their house and people used crackers. And we were like, you know what, Lord, please, this isn't ideal. This isn't the way we really want it to be. But I feel like in this season, the Lord was reminding me, hey, look, I'm doing something special in a season, but it's a season. I have been amazed at how easy it's been for people who are inviting their neighbors to church to just watch online. Yeah. And so we're not, you know, it's kind of tough to track numbers and we're trying not to kind of be David doing a census and counting all the people.
Yes.
But we have way more people watching our services online than normally come on a Sunday morning. And I'm heard probably in this past week, at least 12 different stories of people who are like, my neighbor doesn't go to church, or their church is kind of a church that's not really preaching the gospel. And so I've invited them to listen in and they've been listening in, and the evangelism that's happening, I'm like, man, Lord, this is crazy. I never thought, I mean, it makes sense now. Why would someone who's not a Christian come to church when in the privacy of their home, they could just kind of peek in and spy on what's going on? My next door neighbor, only the Lord could do it. We've been praying for him for a long time. He's watching every service now. He joined my evangelistic Bible study that we're doing over Zoom. So I think, wow, in this season, God's doing something great. I do have a fear that the people who love, we do our service at 10:45. And so people who love sleeping in, getting up, having their coffee and in their pajamas and kind of watching the service, I feel like there will be a number of people who are like, you know what? This is great. I want to do this. But my feeling is there's so much pent up demand. I had an elder last night on our elder meeting Zoom call that was like, I am dying to get back together. So my guess is, I could be wrong, that probably it'll be a slow trickle back, and we're a bigger church. And so one of the fears for us is smaller churches might be allowed to meet, but they might not want bigger churches meeting with bigger numbers. And so how do we think through those kinds of things? And so that's everybody's got their own troubles, and we got probably more people that are able to do videos. And so there's some benefits that way. There's also some downsides of, well, how will we manage this if they don't want, if they only want smaller groups doing, would we just do like 5 services in a day? How would you do that? I think people will slowly start to trickle in, but my prayer and my theology tells me God's presence is so attractive that people will come back for it. And that he's allowing his presence to be in their homes in special ways now, but it's a season and he's going to ask them to come back.
Jim, thanks for that and for your wisdom and your insights. Love you as a friend and grateful for your life and ministry and partnership in the CPT and beyond. And thank you for being on the podcast and this encouraging conversation that I know is going to encourage our podcast listeners. So thank you again for being with us today.
It's mutual, my friends. May God bless you and thanks for having me.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider throwing us a like, sharing the podcast online, subscribing, leaving a review. Anything like that would go a long way towards helping other people hear about the podcast. The CPT Podcast is a ministry of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our host for today's episode was Todd Wilson. Our producer and editor was Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.